Tiffins and Ellen Shankman.
Excuse me, Mr. Carpish, join.
Hello, Gary.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to the people who are on the phone, I hope it.
Sounds like we're still one shy of a quorum.
One shy of a quorum, exactly. Bruce, I've had apologies from Tony Harris. And I've had apologies from Eric Irati, who may not be able to join.
Joining conference.
It's Bruce Tonkin here. Is anyone else still there?
Hi, Bruce. Yes. We are 9.
Is there anything that we can do to start this thing going without a quorum? It would seem to me that if we're getting a...
We've just hit it, I think.
We've got... nobody from the ISPCP and from the non-commercials.
This is Tom, non-commercial constituency.
Glenn, I don't know whether you can hear, but in the background, somebody's logging in from the NC. So
from the non-C, yes. Who's just logged in, please?
Hey Glenn, I just joined. It's Laurence.
Laurence, good, thank you. And somebody else?
This is John Unki, non-commercial constituency.
It's Chan.
Mr. Holmes is joining.
Okay, thank you. Good. Okay.
And Bruce, I heard Tony Holmes come in.
Yes, we can go, Bruce. We've got quorum.
Yes, here. Hi, everyone.
Good. Hello, Tony.
A little bit of confusion, Bruce. I know I'm lazy, but you didn't put the number on the agenda. That may be holding some people up.
Yes, I noticed that. It was actually on a separate email because I was looking that up as well, yes. Okay. I think if we just sort of go through the agenda, summary of last meeting, Glenn, we haven't got the minutes from the Shanghai meeting, is that right?
The transcript is on the website, Bruce.
Excuse me, Mr.
Rufus, join. Okay, so we probably need to...
Do you want me to minute them too, as well as the transcript?
Yeah, I think it's probably worthwhile minuting
okay,
it
fine.
So,
I'll
that we've got the main points
right.
from the meeting.
Okay, I'll do that, don't worry.
Yeah, we'll do that for...
I just left the transcript up to now because I thought that would be sufficient.
We have the issues arising from the last Names Council meeting, which was to talk about, firstly, Louis Tuton's paper on implementation of policies. So I've allocated some time and invited Louis, and he's agreed to join us on this call to be available to answer questions. We've also got an update on where we're going with the UDRP task force. then some discussion on Stuart Lynn's paper on new TLDs, then a couple of items to talk about budget. One is the budget for the current Names Council, which we would look at carrying us through to, I guess, mid-next year. And then the second element of that is looking at a budget for the new GNSO from that period onwards, and at least doing some initial planning there. So that's a sort of rough summary of the agenda. Do we have any other agenda items that people would like to raise?
Yes, Bruce, it's Ken Stubbs. It's not necessarily an agenda item, but it's something that needs to be included, I think, with the agenda topics, and maybe Louis can elaborate on it a little bit more, if not possibly Marilyn. We're in receipt of an email from Dan Halloran outlining some specific implications and actions that would be taken as a result of the proposals that are currently both before the two major task forces. And I think it's important that the Names Council members be appraised of this, either by some sort of briefing or at least having this directed to them as well, because there are going to be certain implications as we move forward on both the transfers as well as the WHOIS issues.
Okay. Yeah, I think we'll take that up in questions with Louis. Any other comments on the agenda first?
Louis, it's Marilyn. I have a comment on the agenda.
Yes, go ahead.
Under other business, I'd like to make a comment about a concern about the limitation of time that is being provided for comment on the CCSO posting. If I just think of that, but for a brief time, I'll make my comment there.
So the limit of time on comments for the, this is the CCNSO assistance group's work, is it?
Okay.
All right, we'll add that to the end if we've got time to raise that. Okay, if we just go to Louis' paper, I guess a quick summary of that from my perspective is it's raising the fact that the current, firstly, that ICANN's regulation is based on a set of contracts. There's a contract between ICANN and the registry. There's a contract or registration accreditation agreement between ICANN and registrars. And then there's also an agreement between the registry and registrars. So we have sort of three main agreements involved there. And then there's also, I guess, an agreement between registrars and registrants. In the main agreements between ICANN and the registries and ICANN and the registrars, there is provision to add additional policies, and there's a definition for the consensus that needs to be formed to add those policies, and Louis addresses that in his paper. Then there's also the issue of what areas are allowable as within the contracts that are topics for consensus policy. One of the things I think is not clear in Louis' paper is in particular with transfers and who is whether or not those topics fall within the areas where consensus policy is covered by the current registry or registrar agreements, or whether the policy areas are not covered and in which case would require the almost complete agreement of registries and registrars. In the registrar agreement, there is a list of topics for new and revised policies, and I'll just quickly run through that list. The first one is issues for which uniform or coordinated resolution is required to facilitate interoperability, technical reliability, or operational stability of registrar services. The second one is policies necessary to implement ICANN policies relating to DNS registry or registry services. third one is resolution of disputes concerning the registration of names. The fourth one is principles for allocation of registered names. And the fifth one is prohibitions on warehousing. The sixth one is maintenance of up-to-date contact information. Seventh is reservation of registered names that may not be registered initially or may not be renewed due to reasons related to avoiding confusion between users, intellectual property or technical management of the DNS. The eighth is procedures regarding suspension or termination of a registry or registrar. And the ninth is dealing with the transfer of registration data upon a change in registrar. My question to Louis, just to start the ball rolling, is that ninth provision that says the transfer of registration data upon a change in registrar, is it your opinion, Louis, that that is a mechanism for there to be a transfers policy, or is transfers policy not actually covered in those nine areas?
Bruce, I do think that transfers policy would generally be covered in those nine areas, of course, depending on exactly on what is proposed as the policy. But if it's what's usually proposed, I think that ninth area you mentioned would cover it.
The ninth area would.
Yeah. Louis, yeah. This is Jay Scott. Maybe it's the lawyer in me, but as Bruce read those, I found a couple of other areas that arguably both the who is and the transfers task force recommendations would fall under the broad provisions of the language that was read that affects those specific areas.
Jay Scott, I think it is the lawyer in you.
The second one here who agrees.
and I must say that as the chair of the transfers task force, I've studied those before myself, Louis, and I don't think it's just the lawyer in them.
No, what I mean is, why are you asking the question if it's covered, I think, fairly clearly by a specific one?
Okay.
Yes, I guess what I'm trying to do is first establish whether the areas of the transfers and who is. I think who is mentioned a number of times throughout the registrar agreement in various places where it says that such and such is the current policy and you know, future ICANN policy established by consensus may change this. So who is, I think, is mentioned a number of times. Transfers is really only mentioned explicitly in that ninth point. But as Jay Scott says, you might be able to say it has bearing on some of the other points. But I think if we can establish that at least the task forces are in areas generally, you know, without going into each specific recommendation, but in the areas that are covered under consensus policy, and then if we can establish that the recommendations that are produced are consensus policies, and I guess there's a set of steps that you have suggested for that, I guess the question then becomes, Louis, how would you see implementing a policy? Is that something that you would just create a document on the ICANN website and say this is now a consensus policy? How would you see it being implemented?
Well, if it goes through all the required... let me back up. First, I think, Bruce, relating to just a comment on your general question about are these things in this scope of consensus policies, that's, of course, a necessary question to answer. For most things, I would think the DNSO or in the future the GNSO would be involved in, they will be in the scope of those policies. The question really is more whether the processes for demonstrating that a consensus has been gathered around the policy, whether those processes have been followed and the result has been achieved. Once you get inside that scope, there are essentially three requirements that must be shown in order to demonstrate that something has risen to the level of a consensus policy. Chronologically, the first of those is that a written report is prepared demonstrating the consensus, including a variety of elements having to do with outreach to all the affected parts, demonstration that any opposition is isolated or irrational, and so forth. The second point is that the Names Council adopt the report as a reflection of the consensus by at least a two-thirds vote. And the third thing is a approval by the ICANN board. If it achieves all of those things, then the document would be presumably posted, but more importantly, communicated to the contracting parties, and they would be advised that it's a consensus policy. There would then be, they have a reasonable time to implement and some certain protections from having to be singled out to bear the burden of the policy, including for registrars and registries. Both there are, you know, mechanisms for them to recover the cost of implementing the policy. There are indemnities if they are subject to legal liability because of the policy, and so forth.
Okay, so the written report, you would then separate that written report in that an element of that would be the actual policy that's if you like, communicated to the contracted parties, and the other element of that is the documentation that supports the consensus for that policy. Is that how you see it?
Yes, that's right. I guess the immediate thing, as you say, to implement it is to communicate it to the contracting party. They then have a variety of mechanisms to challenge whether it's in fact a policy that they must implement. They're, of course, within the ordinary ICANN process, entitled to seek reconsideration from the board, but more importantly, they're contractually entitled to obtain independent review on the merits of the determination that a consensus has been achieved. When I say on the merits, that means that it's not just the procedure that the DNSO or GNSO found it to be a consensus. The council affirmed that by a two-thirds vote and the board adopted it, but also whether, in fact, on the basis of the documentation that was gathered in the process, there has been a consensus shown. If they get through that step, and the independent review affirms that it's a consensus, then have their ordinary arbitration rights.
Vis-a-vis ICANN. Okay, so in regards to the three criteria we have, we need the document, the Names Council can adopt that by two-thirds vote, and then there's the board to approve. Is it possible to get ICANN staff to check the document before it gets to the Names Council for compliance, or at least an opinion on compliance against the contract?
Well, I would assume that in the context of the GNSO, that would be a responsibility of the staff manager.
Philip, another question. If it went through the right three hurdles and was communicated to the contracting parties, and there was a challenge and independent review in terms of was or was or not consensus, the burden of proof would lie with independent review to show there wasn't consensus. Is that correct?
Give me a moment to look at that. Yes, I think in general that's right, Philip. The mode of the review is an independent review, and the burden of at least explaining why there was an error is on the party invoking that review.
Yep.
I should also
okay.
point out, and this is very important, I think, that the decision on independent review must be, in the words of the agreement, based on the report and supporting materials required by, you know, whatever subsection requires the report. So, and of course, that report is required to include all substantive comments that were achieved in the process. But it is not appropriate for a contracting party who doesn't like a prospective policy to just sit back in the weeds, as it were, let the process go through, not speak up, have there be a consensus appear, and then come in to the independent review with 15 of its registrar friends saying, we don't agree with this.
Right.
I'd like to ask a question about that, too. What about the other scenario where a contracting party doesn't participate but commissions a separate study and doesn't submit that documentation to the task force?
I don't think it's necessary that it be, under the agreements, that it be submitted to the task force. Quite in that sense. If you speak more generally in the context of the process that's followed in the supporting organization for development of policy, right. A new element that is not submitted in that process, provided there's an opportunity to submit it in that process, should not be considered in the independent review.
Yeah, the wording that's in the contract, it says that the written report must include all substantive submissions to the supporting organisation. So as you say, it can't just be gossip behind the scenes. It has to be a submission to the supporting organisation.
Yeah, but I just want to note the fact that a task force could be blindsided by submissions going to the SO after the task force comment period is closed.
That's correct, and that's part of the, I think that's contemplated by the procedure, Marilyn. There's a three-step chronologically procedure. There's development, say, by a task force, which puts together the basic report. It then goes to the NAMES or GNSO Council, as the time of occurrence may be, and their task is to determine whether, they should put it out for additional public comment, as is the course, and as is will be provided in the new PDP, I believe. And any new things they get, they should consider as part of their vote on whether, in fact, the written report demonstrates the consensus that is claimed.
So I guess the NAMES Council then, in terms of approval, could say, we approve this report subject to the inclusion of this additional substantive comment that we might receive in the last 2 weeks.
They could do that. Alternatively, they could say, we got this comment, and a couple of alternatives. We got this comment, wasn't it considered by the task force, and they could say either, it should have been, the task force didn't do adequate research or outreach on this, and we're referring it back to the task force to do a supplemental statement. Or they could say there was no reason that this wasn't submitted. There was adequate outreach, and times were clear to the person who submitted this, and we don't think this affects the general view that the process followed has found consensus.
Louis?
Yeah.
This is Jay Scott. There is no requirement that members of a task force that represent particular constituencies are in any way obligated to bring forth every objection that their constituency may have against a policy. In other words, task force comes up with implementation recommendations, and then it goes to public comment, and while the constituency actively participated, or maybe not as actively as everyone else would have liked, in developing those recommendations, constituency could then file a public comment to those that is against the recommendations or some of the recommendations. That still is providing the necessary input. It's just not providing it during the development of the implementation recommendations, but during the comment period. But that's still providing the necessary input, isn't it?
Well, let me answer this in an oblique way. The agreements provide that the report will have three basic elements. First, it should, as Bruce mentioned, in addition to these three elements, it must include all substantive submissions to the supporting organization relating to the proposal. But the three things that the report in addition to those supporting materials, should provide are, first, it must document the extent of agreement and disagreement among impacted groups. Second, it must document the outreach process used to seek to achieve adequate representation of the views of groups that are likely to be impacted. And third, it must document the nature and intensity of reasoned support and opposition to the proposed policy. So an outreach, you know, a demonstration of outreach is one of the elements of that report. So, and I don't exactly know how that relates in terms of what you're thinking, but you know, if you had representatives on the task force from, say, the intellectual property constituency that listened, that were carrying the message of only a small fraction of the broad views of that constituency, and the other views were being made, you know, were being offered in some other way but not accepted, I think you might have a problem in demonstrating consensus ultimately.
Let me ask a further question along that line, though. If during the outreach, in addition to documenting that the task force members have been asked to put forward broad constituency views, further outreach was held that those constituencies participated in, that would be then in the documentation of outreach. So really, the process could supplement any outreach that was done within any particular constituency or other group, but in the consensus process, the consensus might be very difficult to actually document.
Well, I think there are obviously many different ways to achieve outreach. Jay Scott, I think, was positing a situation where the only means of outreach was relying on the representatives of the constituencies involved. That, at least as I have observed the action in the DNSO, and I would expect the same will be true under the PDP and the GNSO, that's a very unusual model. And ordinarily, there are plenty of opportunities through posted notices and opportunities to comment for others to make their views known.
Yeah, I believe, Louis, that if we look at the transfers and who is task forces, that in a number of times they've run public discussions at ICANN meetings, and they've had open teleconference calls. So I think it's not true to say that they've only relied on input from the task force representatives.
Bruce, I want to go back to your earlier question to Louis about looking at the recommendations in the report and getting a staff opinion as to whether it is in compliance with the contractual obligations. His answer was, he assumed under the GNSO that would be the staff manager's responsibility. However, we have two draft reports that are going to be, I assume, Marilyn, put together prior to the steady state of the new ICANN that are going to come through in this interim period. And so my question was, with the policies that are developed there, which looks like transfers and who is, perhaps UDRP, would we be able to get that sort of opinion from staff?
Let me respond to that, Jay Scott. I think obviously we'll work with and try to everyone needs to work a lot, is going to need to work a lot to make sure transition works smoothly. My anticipation is that the GNSO will come into existence, assuming the board acts, at the Amsterdam meeting in mid-December. I'm not clear on exactly what time scale these two task forces and the DNSO are running under right now, and maybe you can illuminate that for me.
Bruce, do you want me to comment on
that? Yes, Marilyn, go ahead. Yeah.
I'll comment on where we are on both the task forces. Just got an echo here. I hope this is not me. And then I have a question, Louis, for you about your assumption that the GNSO will come into existence, because that's not the assumption that I'm operating under in relation to funding support, so we can come back to that. Who is will present recommendations on policy recommendations on two of the four elements for short-term response and lay out the recommendations for any further work that the DNSO/GNSOs should undertake on reserve. So we'll have short-term recommendations on two areas, one on accuracy and one on, short-term recommendations on accuracy and short-term recommendations on resale, bulk access, and reuse of the data. And the other two elements will be laid out for further work, and there'll be a recommendation of outreach that we have already put in place. On transfers, we expect to have recommendations by Amsterdam that propose a, what I'm going to call a standardized transfer framework that will probably also recommend a couple of additional short-term elements that would be dependent on the deletion task force output.
Bruce?
Yes?
I'm sorry to step in with a point of order. It's just a request. Marilyn, I don't know if you were having a problem with the microphone on your phone or not, but I can assure you that your voice is very, very difficult to understand. There's no trouble. It's very fuzzy. I'd appreciate it. I didn't hear the last half of that.
Yeah, I'll just paraphrase what Marilyn said, Ken. Marilyn is chair or co-chair of the WHOIS Task Force and said that it's likely that the WHOIS Task Force will make policy recommendations in two areas. One, accuracy, and the second, bulk access. The Transfers Task Force is likely to propose a framework in advance of the Names Council meeting in December in Amsterdam, and that again will have some short-term recommendations, and it will also foreshadow some work that relies on the Deletes Task Force. So I guess what we're saying, Louis, is that there is likelihood by the end of this year that we would be hoping to get some consensus policy recommendations put to a vote by the Names Council. And if so, I think picking up on what Jay Scott said, there's really two elements. The first element is the policy in or out of scope of the registry or registrar agreements? And the second element is getting an opinion on whether the documentation that has been produced would at least on an opinion of say the General Counsel be consistent with the required documentation for a consensus policy.
I think that in all candor there may be some difficulties just in staffing those requirements. One of the elements of reform, of course, is to increase staff support for these things, and that hasn't been done yet. And that will be something, as Marilyn pointed out, that must be phased over some time because of need to hire people and so forth. I'm hoping, though, that we could get some basic views on at least the at least part of what you're planning to do this year. I should also mention that at least we, in the area of who is, my impression, which Marilyn may correct in a moment, is that some portion of the interim recommendations may not really be things that would be implemented through consensus policy provisions, but may in fact be more in the nature of statements that various policies should be more vigorously enforced, which are, may actually not be policy recommendations at all. Marilyn, can you speak to that?
Yeah, Louis, I think that's absolutely correct. On the accuracy area, some of the short-term recommendations are very much in that space.
Yeah, so that's kind of a recommendation for action by ICANN staff as opposed to a new policy. Is that correct?
I think that's my impression, at least.
And that's how I would see it. Ken might want to comment, too.
Did you have a comment, Ken?
It's Laurence. I can just confirm what Marilyn said. Most of the policies for the accuracy part, well, not most, but a lot, would be implementation of the existing policies.
Okay. Now, just one other area of clarification. In the last Names Council meeting, it was raised that some of the work of the task forces was getting into a lot of administration detail, and the question was raised that whether that was appropriate for policy development, whether policy development should just set general guidelines. At least my reading of the contracts would not try and exclude a statement such as something that needs to be done within a time limit, like a response is required in 3 days. I would have thought, provided that there was consensus on that particular point, that could be included in the policy. Is that your read, Louis?
Yes, I think in general, something in the nature of, it ought to provide for, a response in, like you say, a number of days. That could be part of the policy. I think, though, that I didn't hear that, of course, I wasn't on the last Names Council call. But
there
I think
a physical
in general,
meeting in,
the observation is a good one, that a policy development body doesn't advance matters much by getting into the details of trying to figure out exactly how to implement policy. It should focus on what are the essential elements of the policy, there may be a need in subsequent procedures, either at the board level or in crafting any written explanation of the policy or whatnot, to allow the flexibility of those people to be able to generate something that's going to be able to stick. When you're talking about policies that will require great efforts by providers, you can anticipate that they will carefully scrutinize them, and it will make it difficult to implement if there are elements in them that are that turn up to be very burdensome and so forth.
Bruce, Ken Stubbs.
Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to reinforce what Louis said using the term stick. I see as a good example of that a posting that came through just today from Scott Hollenbeck with the discussion that a 15-day response period for accuracy and position might not be enough time to secure if an email address is used to contact somebody and it's not good. If you have to use postal mail, it 15 days may be inadequate depending on the part of the world. I'm still waiting for postcards to come back from Shanghai, hello. So I think the important thing is the ability to implement, I think, is there.
So can I understand then again the process, Louis, that are you saying that there's a further step that might be between a policy is posted and I guess it's advised to contracted parties, ICANN staff might adjust the wording in such a way so it was implementable without going through a further policy process? Is that the sorts of thing we're talking about? Because
I would anticipate that occurring in most cases.
Yes.
The experience we've had is that when you that policies are often most expressible and consensus developed around what I'll call the essential elements of a policy is generally what ought to happen and things where time frames are stated. Sometimes it's important that they be exactly this. Sometimes there may be some variation, and it doesn't really much matter to the consensus whether something is 7 or 10 days or something.
Yeah.
The practical reality of implementing something is that there are a whole range of ways to implement it, And one of the most, or in fact the most effective way, is clearly to get those responsible for implementing it to agree to a specific time frame. And, for example, if I didn't see the Scott Hollenbeck thing, but if the policy process, says something ought to be 7 days, and really the consensus doesn't much care whether it's 7 or 10, and the providers would prefer 10, the reality is that fact doesn't usually come out until the last moment. Louis?
Bruce, I want to get you for a question,
please. As a matter of practicality, Louis, would it be better to make recommendations in a broader sense to say something to the effect that the consensus is that XYZ needs to occur within a time certain, and that time certain needs to be standard across all affected parties?
I think that in general, if that is what the consensus truly holds, that's better, to be more general. And what I'm suggesting, I realize, is entails an amount of work in the consensus development process, because it requires that you try to identify what's really important to the consensus and what's not.
Yeah, and I think what the issue is probably that you kind of, when you're saying a time limit, you want to know, is it days, weeks, or months? And so if a policy said, the time limit's 3 days or something, you could expect that after registrars look at that and they say, well, actually 5 days is better than three, you would accept that. But if they suddenly said, well, actually 6 months is better than 3 days, then you that's probably something that requires the policy to look at it again.
Can I ask, I want to ask Louis a question.
Go ahead, Marilyn.
Louis, I think I want to take us up an element to something that's coming across very clearly that I have a concern about and want to raise with the policy development entity of that relates to domain names, the Names Council, and you as the General Counsel. We built a policy development process on a good faith assumption that knowledgeable chartered individuals participate in a policy development process in good faith, and they provide information and feedback both ways. And we built in safeguards for further outreach by the task forces to ensure that there are other mechanisms to take input. We now put forward a recommendation from the task force, and what I'm hearing, and I'm not disagreeing with it, I just want to go through the risk here that I see, or perhaps the loophole we should think about. The task force put forward a framework, and it recommends things like standardized deletion periods or a framework that is applicable to all and has certain characteristics. The staff now sits down with the quota sector or contracting parties and enters into the more detailed implementation of the policy recommendation. And what I'm interested in is, how does that more detailed recommendation then come back for a look by the policy body before it's implemented? Because it's very conceivable that in implementation, I do policy for a living. It's very conceivable that in implementation, a critical factor of the consensus could have dropped out, or something that has a direct impact on another affected party, like registrants, could be overlooked.
Well, one mechanism, your question poses a serious problem, and one that probably won't be solved in this conversation or with my answer. But generally, what I was advocating was that some attention be paid in the consensus development process and in the statement of what the consensus is to articulate what factors are critical and what factors are not.
I understand that, but what I was defining, Louis, what I was describing is a fallout that could inadvertently occur in the negotiation on implementation, I think what you were describing is that staff sits down with the contracting parties and develops an implementation of the policy recommendation. What I was describing was an inadvertent fallout of a key element that would affect, for instance, restaurants and wouldn't be reflected in the implementation design, even accidentally. So my question was, is there a point built in that before the policy is implemented, it's posted again or reviewed by the policy body?
I think the answer to your question is that generally the way things flow, the answer is no, because policies are recommended by the policy development body, then taken to the board. The board either approves them or does not approve them. The board acts on some additional information that may not be available because ordinarily there is public comment that may be raised there as well to ensure that those outside of the supporting organization have sufficient outreach. And then including, for example, the various advisory committees that under the new bylaws will have various opportunities to give advice about these things. And then, of course, in the case of the kinds of policies we're talking about, there will be the potential for things such as price adjustments if it imposes costs on the providers and so forth. And in order to come to closure, I don't think it can go around in a perpetual circle that after all that goes and then it goes back to the supporting organization, they do their thing and it goes through the process again. I think you would never come to a policy.
Yeah, I think the critical thing there, Marilyn, is that the policy document itself is fairly explicit, I think, in what Louis mentioned, that where an area is critical, the policy needs to clearly explain that, because that's then a guideline for the staff to then actually implement it. It's no different to a board decision to say, create a process for, say, new TLDs. The board will come up with the general policy, but the staff still has to provide the detail underneath that.
And I should just emphasize that, of course, there are mechanisms in place to make sure the staff follows the instructions, including the reconsideration policy and lots of other things.
Yeah. Bruce?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, my perception of this process is that it's consultative in the development, but when we arrive at a structured policy, the implementation really belongs with the staff and the providers, those who have to carry out the actions outlined in the policy. And I think from a practical standpoint, the staff and the providers working together need to develop some sort of procedures that fall within the policy but are practical, and that's, to me, the practicality is the whole key. If we have to go back to a consultative process every single time, if we give somebody guidelines that say a reasonable time period should be allowed for in the system to give the registrant opportunity to respond to some sort of an inquiry that's made, I think we need to allow staff and the providers to determine within their areas of experience and so forth what constitutes a reasonable period of time. And I think that after this has been established, procedure's been established, I don't think that it's necessary to go back to consultative, back to a task force again to say, well, you said reasonable, is this all right with you? Then we go right back into this endless loop because there's always going to be somebody who may or may not be happy with something.
Let me just respond that I'm not suggesting it come back to the task force. I was suggesting that it come back to the policy organ, so to speak, the supporting organization. But I still have a question, Bruce, that I want to ask Lily. You know, we are acting as though, and I just want to make this statement for the record, and then we can move on from my point of view. We're acting as though decisions between providers don't have significant impact and implications for registrants, IP holders, et cetera, when we say that implementation is only between the staff and the providers, which was why I raised the previous question. And we also still seem to be firmly entrenched in a view that policy making, not just approval, can be elevated to the board. So my statement would be, for the record, that if during the implementation phase policy areas emerge that have not been thought about, that there should be a mechanism to refer those to the supporting organization.
This is Harold. By the way, I want to join in Marilyn's general observation and concern about this particular aspect.
This is Jay Scott. I disagree that what Louis has outlined, elevating policy development to the board. And in my tenure in this process, many times staff implementations that have been developed, while it's not a requirement, has been brought back to the community with a public posting and a time for public comment. And I agree with Ken and Louis that it is imperative that a task force identify the critical issues that are those issues and those elements of the recommendations that are central to consensus, so that there are flexibility between the parties that have to work out the details, that they still fall within those critical central issues within the consensus, but have room to develop a reasonable plan for implementation that falls within the contractual obligations that the parties have between themselves.
Could I get into the queue, please?
Yeah, go ahead.
Could you add Tony as well, please?
I think what we are experiencing here is some part of a very classical debate. It's basically Lawrence Lessig's theme that implementation may actually be policy. Let me give one example. It's, I think, from New York, where in the 1960s, access to beaches was supposed to be available to all races. Now, what happened? Some city official made sure that bridges across streets were built in a very low way, so public transportation couldn't get below the bridges. So certain racial groups, which typically used public transportation, ultimately couldn't go to the beach. At this point, really architecture and implementation became a policy question, and for this reason, I think that Marilyn really has been making an important point. If implementation raises new policy questions, like should there be public transportation to the beaches, then this should possibly be referred back to an SO. But, of course, if implementation really sticks to that and really sticks to the framework, does not produce new questions, in this case, it should be left to staff. So if a task force says something should happen in a short time frame, like scale of days, that's okay for staff and implementers to say, okay, it's 5 days or it's 7 days or 3 days. But if policy development gives another scale and implementation wants to deviate from that, then it should be referred back. Things like that. I think there is a distinction between moving the entire policy development process to the board or to the staff there's a distinction between referring certain problems back to the SO and referring back the entire implementation to the SO. The last thing wouldn't be practical, but the first thing would be important, I think. Maybe
okay. Thanks for that, Thomas. Tony, you're next.
Yes, so I think my point was similar to the previous one. there has to be some accountability here, and certainly when we get into an area where the discussions are proving difficult between the staff and other parties, and it's over the interpretation of what's actually been set out in the policy formation process, perhaps where it is rather general, then without doubt that needs to have some referral. And I'm not in favour of putting it right back to a task force. I don't think that's particularly helpful, but it should certainly go back to the council itself to have some consideration and discussion there.
Bruce, this is Harold. Can I get in the queue, please?
Yes, go ahead, Harold.
Okay. In response to what Thomas was saying, I think it's a lot less. I agree with everything Thomas said, but there's a much more, much less subtle and much more express issue that I worry about, which is that even with the new procedures for documenting consensus, consensus is a very slippery thing to define, and my concern is that because there are these opportunities for further input, that there is a very real possibility, not just in sort of in sort of subtle ways of implementation, but in sort of real ways of moving forward, in which the policy debate elevates up without coming back down after a substantive shift, and that's somewhat much more than esoteric manners of implementation to achieve policy ends is a lot more of what I'm worried about.
This is Ken. Would you put me in the queue, please?
Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
I'm sorry. I thought there was somebody out ahead of me. The only thing I'm really getting concerned about is that we're going to be spending so much time talking about policies and implementing policies that they're never going to get implemented. Every time you take a step backwards in this process, referring back, whatever you want to call it, you add a significant time period, because if you then decide that the implementation needs to be referred back to make sure that the implementation of the policy who you're principally designating to ICANN, but you want to make sure that ICANN's really doing what you told them you really think they need to do, you bring it back, then you have to go back to consultative for each one of the constituencies in the Names Council, which adds a significant time period, because all of these constituencies are not necessarily real-time, 3 to 5 days, give me a yes or no type deal. What you're going to do is add months and months and months onto some of these processes being implemented, which only adds to the injury in many cases that's created by the fact that the policy was never implemented. So I'm just saying you're adding a significant amount of damage as a result of what you're discussing.
My only response is, Marilyn, is I think these are really the exceptions and not the rule. I would hope that this would be really rare, rare instances.
Tony here, and I have the same view. I don't think we're saying we should refer everything back. Issues that come back are going to be issues of substance. They're going to be important issues, and I would personally rather policy took longer to implement than implement something that's totally unacceptable.
In a quick response to what you just said, someone has to define substance. What is not substantive to you, Tony, may very well be substantive to Harold. And now you have to establish some sort of guidelines to determine when an issue is deemed to be substantive, and some sort of a process for ensuring that someone who has concerns about an issue being substantive has the opportunity to get that back before the appropriate body. So you're just...
Would you not agree, Ken, that if that's the case, then the determination of that is probably issues where there are, let's say, strong counter feelings on both sides, over something that cannot be resolved in any way between those parties.
This is Bruce talking. I don't want this discussion to go on forever, because I think we've probably got the main points of view. The issue, I think the key issue here is that we're still in the process of developing our processes. So I would actually be pleased that we actually got to the point that we had a consensus policy to implement, and then start looking at those issues at that time. Because I think you're right, some of those issues will come up and there will be some areas of disagreement, but I think they'll naturally be handled, because bear in mind that the GNSO in the future is still going to be there, and if the constituency sees something going off track, they will be able to raise it at the GNSO, and the GNSO will be able to get involved. So there's nothing that we're doing that precludes further development using the normal policy process, I think. Are there any other major questions for Louis before we move on to the next topic?
We have been able on the Transfer Task Force to rely on some assistance from Dan Halloran and from you, and thank you very much for that support. I think what I heard you saying, and I just wanted to not really put you on the spot, but what I heard you saying is that to the best extent of staff resources possible, that you will try to provide the kind of necessary consultation to us that we need to be cognizant of the severe limitations of staff time.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and that consultation might even be in the form of a verbal consultation, as opposed to requiring Louis to write a report. Is that fair?
From my perspective, it's often a lot easier to get on a call like this than to write detailed reports.
Yes, yeah, I think accept that. Okay, well, I'd just like to thank you, Louis, for allocating time to talk with us, because I think it's been very useful to go through the issues that have been raised. So thank you for taking the time.
All right, thank you much, and I'll depart now. Bye.
Okay, bye. The next item on the agenda is a update on the UDRP task force work. Jay Scott, can you just respond to that fairly briefly, please?
Yes. Bruce, I apologize to the rest of the names council. I am at a remote location and do not have a copy of the email that I sent out to the current task force members. And Bruce, I believe I sent you a copy.
Yes, but I did see a copy of that.
In my email, I set forth a modified version of the PDP that was developed in the Blueprint for Reform, applying specifically to the UDRP task force. I've also contacted all of the members of the original task force, identified a number of those who are very interested and excited about continuing and are happy to contribute to the task force, and I've also identified a few individuals that are not going to participate due to life and responsibility changes within their personal and professional lives that will preclude them operating within the estimated time frame that I've put forth in my email. I have contacted groups where an individual was nominated by a certain group and has indicated that they would not be able to continue to proceed with us, and asked them to nominate another individual representing that particular identified interest that was set forth in the original terms of reference. I would also like today to ask Bruce if we could put forth a motion that the Names Council extend an invitation to the new Asian fighter that has, since the original terms of reference, been added as a provider of services, and add a provider representative and a panelist representative from that organization, so that we will balance, I think, was the original goal of election of the members of the task force. We are going to be having our first conference call, and thank you, Glenn, who has assisted me on getting some details, and I'm still working through that on a funding level of how we're going to do that. We are going to have a conference call Tuesday the 19th at, I believe, and I'm so terrible at this, so apologize to the international members that I'm terrible at this, but 1500 UTC, which is 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern Standard Time. That is when the majority of the task force members could meet, and we are going to prepare to put forth our preliminary report, I believe is how I crafted it in my email, Bruce, which is going to be a review of the articles and studies that have been done of the UDRP, along with the survey results, that sort of give it, craft us an idea of where we're going to be going. I have recently, just as early as late as yesterday, received word that Jeff Newman will not be able to participate for the GTLD task force, and he is seeking to find a new representative here. And we are moving ahead in the hopes that by late December we will have a preliminary report that analyzes and codifies the criticisms and analysis that we have been supplied by outside third-party sources and the survey of the UDRP, with the hope of having a draft put together by the spring ICANN meeting, a draft report. And I will be happy when I return to my office to post my email that I copied Bruce to the whole Names Council, or you can check the archives list on the task force archive, and I believe you can see that email setting forth the particular schedule that I've outlined.
Okay, J. Scott, this is Bruce Tonkin. Just to clarify that the membership of the task force as it stands is, there's roughly, what, one member per constituency, is that right?
That's correct, and then there is also a complainant representative whom has identified that she will not be able to continue, and I have asked Phil Shepard to work with me in finding another complainant, which would probably be a business that has been in the position of complainant, and another nominee for that slot.
You talked about a representative from the Asian dispute provider. Are there representatives from the other dispute providers? Is
there are. And
that's independent of the constituency reps, isn't it?
That's correct. And the CR representative from the provider side indicated he does not have time to participate, but his panelist is continuing to participate. E-Resolutions panelist is still participating, Ethan Cash, but I have not heard back from their provider representative. And Eric Vilbers from WIPO is the provider, and I have not heard back from him, but their panelist, Mac Walbaum, has indicated that he will participate, and NAF, National Arbitration Foundation, Tim Cole, and James Carmody, their provider representative and panelist representative, have both indicated that they want to continue, as CPR's panelist representative also has said that he wants to continue.
So I think the issue, I mean, in response to your request, I think, one, that there is consistency in that we have I guess in the GNSO terminology, an expert representative from the Asian dispute resolution, which is separate to constituency reps, and I guess that it's probably sensible from even a geographic diversity point of view that you do get input from that region of the world, because there may be aspects of dispute resolution there that weren't envisaged perhaps when the EDRP was originally developed. And I'm thinking in terms of the types of evidence and communication that may vary in different regions of the world.
I think it's extremely important that the Asian view is present on the task force, because right now we are heavily dominated by the Western culture, and I would like to have these folks on board because they are experiencing a level of participation in their sector of the world that is quite different than the other providers.
Okay, so you, So I'm happy to entertain a motion at this meeting because I don't believe that it's a major policy issue. It's really a procedural issue and it's consistent with the structure of the original task force. Would someone like to second a motion that we appoint a representative from the Asia-Pacific dispute resolution provider to the task force?
Well, this is Ellen Shankman.
Okay. All those in favour say aye.
Aye.
And is there any against?
Bruce, I'm not against or abstaining, but after coming to the vote, I want to make a comment.
Okay. So I'll just go through the vote first, Marilyn.
Yeah.
So any against? Any abstentions? Okay, we'll note that resolution is passed. Marilyn, your comment?
J. Scott, I'll talk to you in more detail offline, but I would like to advise the Names Council that I'm very pleased to see that you're moving ahead. We are encountering a significant number of attacks on our brand names by registrants, particularly in some of the regions that we've just discussed. That will not, of course, be presently reflected in the data of the present UDRP, but will begin to emerge over probably the next 3 to 8 months of time as a very visible practice that is going on, where names are being taken and sort of a resurgence of the cyber squatting activity that was at one point very dominant in the United States. So I foresee a huge number of UDRPs emerging out of some of the other regions.
Marilyn, I'll tell you this, that I think everyone on the call will agree that whenever new real estate opens, and many times those are becoming CCTLDs that are opening new real estate and becoming open TLDs, go through the same cyber squatting flux too. So the importance of the UDRP is in no way diminished just because some of the .com, .net, and .org problems have been weeded through in the 2.5 years since its implementation.
Yeah, I should just clarify. Our problems are in .com and .net.
Okay.
Bruce?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to make a real quick comment, if I could, in response to some of the issues that were brought up here.
Yes,
I would also strongly encourage the task force to take a look at the experience of the new TLDs that have recently been introduced over the last 18 to 20 months. The original terms of reference and most of the survey work and so forth only contemplated the issues with ComNet and Org, but I think it's important to take a close look because I have been reading where there are a significant amount of activity and marks that are related to new top-level domains as well as the CC. So hopefully, J. Scott, you guys are looking in that direction as well.
Well, Ken, basically, as I see it, the UDRP applies to all the new TLDs. Now, the startup procedures that had a startup dispute resolution policy that was a modification of the UDRP will be reviewed when the GTLD evaluation takes place. They're going to look at which model effectively worked. We certainly will bring to bear any comments or procedures in those new modified procedures that might work to solve some of the issues identified in the terms of reference, but we are not, in my mind at least, charged with, nor should we be charged with, comparing the UDRP with these other vehicles for dispute resolution and saying which of these is the better vehicle. I think that the GTLD task force is charged with seeing in the proof of concept that came about with the different TLDs, which of those elements worked, and of those elements, one of those being the expedited dispute resolution process that was put into place. But the UDRP applies to all of the new TLDs.
Yeah, I think the issue, I think Ken's saying, is that there is experience that's been gained in that process that might help guide the UDRP development. So I agree it's not a case of the task force evaluating those other proposals, but I think as part of submissions to the UDRP task force, it would be appropriate to say, well, this is a different approach that was used, and this was some of the results that have been achieved so far.
And I think that
just to make a comment
of having WIPO and NAF, the people who are actually running those particular dispute resolution models, along with the UDRP as a member of our task force, it's my hope that their insight, because they are involved in that process, that will come through.
Thanks for the clarification, Bruce. That's exactly the point I was trying to make.
Yeah.
Sorry,
Philip. Philip, did you have a comment?
I did. If I just got almost answered, I was going to say that my belief is that because of the way we set up this task force with a considerable body of experts in addition to our normal constituency members, I think indeed the expertise necessary to factor in precisely the point Ken made is already on the team.
I'm Kerry to speak, please.
Go ahead, Kerry.
There is something of a proliferation of DRPs afoot here, and if every new context brings with it a batch of new DRPs specific to that, at least conceived specific to that context, maybe everything is going to become defocused in a manner that serves no concrete purpose whatsoever. So if the UDRP is the seminal one of the DRPs, perhaps there could be some fruitful cross-pollination going on between what this task force is busy thinking and the burgeoning efforts at addressing modes of handling other kinds of dispute resolution.
I think you're right, Kerry, but as a person who helped work with Louis in crafting the models that were put forth by the GTLD registries and the chartered TDL registries in the proof of concept, and representing trademark owners that had to unfortunately deal with nuances of each flavor of DRP that was out there, I will tell you that we were told that it's a proof of concept. In proof of concept, different models will be accepted, and we're going to have to work within that. We are not going to force them to use one particular type. But when the proof of concept is through, we will then put together, hopefully, one of those choices, one of those flavors that were trotted out in proof of concept, that then will be applied and required of all future offers of namespace.
Yeah, so essentially what you're talking about is the separation of a dispute process that might occur during a startup phase from the UDRP that occurs at any stage. And your focus is on UDRP, but it would take into account some of the lessons learned by the providers in that startup process.
And it very well may be that we say that the UDRP would work on both ends. That it is the best
or a modified version of the UDRP.
Or a modified version of the versions, the flavors that we have seen. This seems to be the most effective flavor, and we recommend on the beginning, the startup phase, this flavor is used, and then the UDRP is, if we should suggest modification as modified, should continue on the back end.
Well, then the U becomes unified rather than uniform.
Well, to tell you the truth, when it was originally contemplated, it was that uniform was used in both of those conceptualized meanings.
Okay, I'm just conscious of time here. I think we've got this is just basically a report on progress, and certainly there is opportunity during the UDRP task force to provide the sort of input we're talking about now. The next item on the agenda, new TLD process. Yes,
sorry,
go ahead.
I was muted when I tried to talk before, so sorry for interrupting you. I have one question on the membership of the task force. I've been hearing about the complainant representative. Is there any specific representative of the respondent side. I'm not talking about systematic cyber scholars, but not every UDRP decision or proceeding is clear. And I think there may be some points of view which should be taken into account on that.
Thomas? John D. Berryhill.
Okay.
Yeah, is representing the respondent. And he is an attorney that represents respondents routinely. And he is also a fairly prolific author on the respondent's position. So I think you're very well represented.
And I'm sorry, I have a question as well.
Okay, go ahead.
Jake, what I didn't understand, maybe I didn't get it in my notes. Who's representing the CCTLD and participating?
Marilyn, I don't have the list in front of me, but they do have a representative, I believe. And if you will allow me some time, when I return to my office on Monday, I will circulate that name. I just have the list with me.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay. New TLD process. Stuart Lynn, a document has been published which has got some, I think, personal recommendations from Stuart, which are in sort of three broad areas. The first area is that the board could consider extending...
Bruce, sorry to interrupt before you going on that. I'm just thinking in terms of timetabling. A TLD discussion could keep us going for hours. Do you have decisions you want to get out of items 6 and 7 on budget? In which case it may be fruitful perhaps to take those first, and in the remaining time we could talk about...
No, I'm not looking for decisions directly, Philip, but I take the point. On this item as well, I don't see having a huge discussion. I really just want to report on the proposal Stuart's had and really foreshadow what might come up at the Names Council level. So basically, the three elements of Stuart's proposal, some have elements that we need to look at, others don't. The first element is suggesting a extension of the proof of concept for three additional sponsored TLDs. And I think people that want to comment on that should comment to the ICANN website. The second one is a plan for implementing the recommendations of the committee that looked at how to go about evaluating the new TLDs, and it's really just sort of documenting or explaining, recommending a set of approaches to go ahead with that evaluation. And again, that's open for public comment. The third item, which is relevant to us, is he's recommending that the board ask the DNSO for advice on how to evolve the top-level generic namespace. Now, as far as I know, the board would then look at his recommendations in the board's meeting in December, and then if these recommendations are followed, we would receive a formal request to the DNSO for advice. I think all I really want to do in this call is just raise that for people to think about. My suggestion, if this is forwarded to the DNSO, is that they're asking for advice rather than asking for us to develop a policy at this stage, that we would probably handle that by getting each of the constituencies to create a position, and then we'd consider that at the Names Council level as a whole, decide whether there's some commonality amongst the responses, and if there is, we can provide the advice back to the board. But I think the decision that they're really looking at is on the critical areas. Should there be a taxonomy of names in the GTLD area, or should we leave it to market forces? In other words, we leave it open to proposals. So I think that's probably the policy question that we would look at. And I would be looking, this is sort of looking towards the probably January timeframe next year, looking for submissions from the constituencies on that question, either for creating a taxonomy or leaving it to market forces. And then if we get some level of support at that point, we could decide whether we wanted to do further work on actually developing a taxonomy. That's kind of my view, just flagging it as I think it's an activity for the Names Council probably in January.
and just invite any general comments on that process rather than on the content. Would anyone else like to comment?
Yeah,
please. Carrie to comment.
Yeah, Carrie and Philip and Ken. Go ahead, Carrie.
Yeah, unfortunately, there is a museum person on the Names Council who works on a daily basis with dyed-in-the-wool taxonomists, and I think the term itself may be not entirely appropriate in present context, and there's always going to be a taxonomy, however we set up the DNS. The domain names within the DNS, because a taxonomy simply describes the relationships between things that already exist, and the notion of a generative taxonomy, that here is a taxonomy on the basis of which non-existent things will come into existence, is kind of rocky. I mean, we're talking about either TLD strings that have inherent allure and people will gather around them, or TLD strings that are created because there is some specific community that is expected to be served by them. And I don't think that the term taxonomy needs to be anywhere near the discussion. I'll get back to that later. You haven't heard the last of me.
Okay, I'll accept that. Go ahead, Philip.
I also I'd raise it in Shanghai. You had used Stuart Lynn's characterization, indeed, of either a taxonomic structure or market forces, and I think also that's an unfortunate characterization in that it seems to suggest that market forces would not apply to a taxonomic structure, and I think that is also an open question. I think Stuart Lynn's view of the world or the two options are perhaps better described as I know, taxonomic versus random application rather than anything else. But
yes, I think he's trying to sort of put two extremes, and perhaps I can accept what Carrie's saying about taxonomy. Perhaps the word is, I mean, one approach is that we actually select a set of names in advance, like they did when they originally set up the top level of the DNS. So you might say, you know, the list of names is based on the ISO standards for country codes, for example, is actually making a decision there. The other one in advance and then inviting proposals for each of those names. The other approach is just inviting a proposal for a name, whatever that name may be. So I accept that. And I think what you're saying is that in a constituency's response, it might well identify some other options there for consideration. Ken, you were next.
Yeah, Bruce, I just need a little clarification for agenda purposes. Are you proposing that the discussion of of Stuart's proposal be continued into the meeting in December, or are you proposing that some sort of an outline of issues that might be considered by the council under Stuart's comments be crafted and then sent out to the constituencies for their response and comment prior to a meeting in January? I think it's important to give us enough lead time if we need to do any consultations. Especially.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the intent of what I'm trying to do, is give a bit of lead time so people can think about it within their constituencies. But the thing, as I understand it, it is a personal paper from Stuart for consideration by the board in December. I think we would then take action after that board consideration at the Names Council level. Now, in the interim period between now and the board meeting in December, Stuart's personal submission is open for comment, so you know, anyone, any individual or any constituency could comment. But in terms of dealing with it as a policy issue at the Names Council, I'm proposing that we wait until after that December meeting.
Yeah, I would express a little concern because I went to the comments section and so far there's only one comment posted, and hopefully there are constituencies on this call that have some issues with Stuart's proposal that might want to get on the record, because I'd hate to have some of these come up in January without any sort of heads up earlier.
Yeah, so certainly I would agree that we would certainly recommend to the members of the Names Council that they consult with their constituencies and consider putting in a position. Is there any other one? Anyone else want to comment?
Yeah, this is Harold.
Yeah, go ahead, Harold.
I just, number one, I'm very pleased to have the clarification of the status of this paper, because I have to say it was unclear whether this was Stewart acting in some sort of official capacity or simply a sort of personal by the president of ICANN.
Well, let me clarify that, Harold. The wording in the introductory paragraph is that in the August meeting of the board asked Stewart to produce a plan for action.
Right.
And he has basically then written that plan for action, and then the board needs to consider it. So I guess it's a bit more than a personal response in that he's doing it as president of ICANN.
Right.
Sorry,
I just wanted to speak.
I think I'll just let Harold speak first, and then I'll go to you, Karen.
I guess my interest here, sort of procedurally as we move on this, is just in terms of what has been referred to the Names Council. It's not as if there's been anything referred to us officially.
That's correct.
Consideration,
yes.
That we are. This is. I'm particularly trying to address Ken's statement about getting things on the record, and this is one of those things that I'm always, sort of worried about, is the question of where people with very limited resources feel that they are going to be able to intervene effectively in a way that really impacts the process meaningfully. I guess there's an opportunity to influence discussion at an early stage, but in terms of sort of what official action is contemplated to be taken, I just want to make it clear that the failure to act before the board takes this up and puts it, and advances the ball into an official process should not be interpreted as saying that people haven't endorsed it or aren't thinking about it. I think there's just a very real sort of commenting on resources question, particularly among those of us that have very limited resources we can address to ICANN issues.
Yeah, I think, Harold, if I can just comment on that. Of the three areas, the first area where he's actually proposing to effectively solicit up to three additional sponsored TLDs, he's saying that's an extension of the original proof of concept. If you wanted to comment on that item, you need to comment on that item before the meeting in December. If you're talking about the issue of how to create the namespace generically into the future, let's say if we had 100 or 1,000 names, that's something that he is recommending is referred to the DNSO. So on that larger policy issue, you will have ample opportunity for input into that following December.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Carrie, you were next.
I think we should be careful about reading too much into what Stewart said. I mean, he's simply articulated what's absolutely obvious. There are two basic approaches. Either we are open for any suggestions whatsoever, or there is some principle that's articulated up front that would restrict the scope of the proposals. And everything beyond that is just a matter of numerical detail. How much does it cost? How many are we going to have? However, I would think that the smaller the number is, the easier it would be to have some sort of a generative principle. So there's some linkage between those two notions. But otherwise, I'm somewhat unsettled hearing this slightly barbed criticism about Stewart's personal opinion. And Stewart is delineating what I would have regarded as the obvious components of the process. And although he's certainly going to be articulating his own personal preference throughout, there's nothing really mystical or magical about any of this.
Hey, Karen, when I want to criticize somebody, you will know. I have not been shy about that in the past. My point is that the status of this document and what needs to be done to have a profound impact on the debate has been, frankly, not entirely clear, and I'm very pleased to have that explained.
Okay, anyone else want to comment?
Grace, it's Marilyn.
Yep, go ahead, Marilyn.
Just a real quick FYI for everyone. I'm not expecting you to pay real close attention to all the details in MOU 5, but I just want to call to everyone's attention that in the MOU with ICANN, I can has been instructed to, and I'm paraphrasing this, so I don't want to be quoted exactly, to develop a clear, transparent process for the introduction of any further new GTLDs. So, you know, this is on their task list, which to do between now and September. It's not a question of introducing new GTLDs, it's a question of devising the process.
Yeah, except that what he's proposing in his first part, Marilyn, is not that. He's saying that under the initial proof of concept that has already been agreed, he's wanting to add three more TLDs to that.
I'm aware. I wasn't commenting on the entirety of his proposal.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But you're right. In the general sense, in terms of moving forward, which is really the third item where he's asking the board, ask the DNSO for advice, that is consistent with their requirements under the MOU. Any other comments? Okay. The next item in the agenda is relating to budget. I'm not sure. It sounds like Roger Caccetti's not on the call. Is that correct? Okay. I think the issue here, and I'll really just summarise, because I know Roger has actually scheduled a budget committee meeting. I think it's next week. And then it's a formal meeting of the budget committee, and we'll get a response from that. But there was a informal meeting in Shanghai of the members of the budget committee that were available at that meeting, which was held with Stuart Lin and Louis Tuton. It became apparent that, and I think this relates to a question Marilyn was asking Louis, but I don't think Louis actually responded, but it became apparent that the new budget from ICANN that would actually pay for staffing for the GNSO and pay for policy development support may not be in place until the until, say, 1st of July 2003. And that means that the DNSO itself needs to plan, even if we don't necessarily need to use the whole budget, but we need to plan to operate under our own resources until the 30th of June next year. And it would appear, based on our current financial status, I think we will have a balance at the end of the year around the sort of $25,000-$30,000 mark. Is that correct, Glenn?
Yes, that's correct.
And we that will not be sufficient to guarantee that we can continue the activities through to the 30th of June next year. And so one of the things that the budget committee needs to do is consider what additional constituency contributions would be required for the first half of next year. So that's really a very quick summary, I think, of where we are with the current DNSO budget. And really just to invite any quick comments that people might want to add. But the budget committee would formally meet on this topic next week.
Bruce, this is Jay Scott.
Yep, Jay Scott.
It seems to me that we could solve a lot of these problems if those in arrearages would just pay their past dues. I can't reach out to the specific number, but speaking as a Names Council representative that is taking increasing heat from his paying membership, that others that are having substantial influence on decisions made by the Names Council yet pay their way, that we could solve a lot of problems just getting our money that is owed to us back pay without having to reassess more money that then won't be paid by certain people and ride on the back of those of us that actually pay our bills.
Okay, that is noted. Anyone else want to comment?
I would say one thing. It's Marilyn.
Yep.
I'd like to note that I owe Roger informationally documentation on the cost of the conference call for transfers, and it is to supplement the support that's already been provided by Glenn through the Secretariat so that we have a good sense of what
cost may be for task forces going forward. But I mention it only to perhaps to say a word of appreciation to Glenn for her efforts and support for the work of the task forces, which is absolutely invaluable. And I know we are going to have a number of task forces continuing to work between now and when budgeting becomes available. So I will mention it to Roger, but I want to mention it to all of you as well, that we need to factor that support into our planning.
Yeah, can I just clarify, Marilyn, that my understanding is that AT&T has effectively picked up the cost of some of those calls, but certainly in the future and as a general principle, the names count. Well, the DNSO should fund the cost of task force calls. Is that a rough?
We have funded. I fund out of my my budget the cost of the transfers and who is calls, the conference calls, and I fund transcripts. Glenn provides administrative support and also has in the past provided support for MP3 recordings. So there has been support from the Names Council, but not the cost of the conference calls. I strongly support that the Names Council fund the task force support for the obvious reasons that I'll state it. This is, agency does not, we get no discount of any kind in the support to fund the cost of the conference calls. A volunteer can't be expected to fund this. This has been an exception that we were willing to do.
Absolutely. And I think the critical thing, what you're saying is that those costs have been hidden.
Right.
And we should be aware of those costs for budgeting purposes, and I agree with that. Yeah.
Because we want to have the task forces chaired by a wide number of people, not necessarily someone who has a separate budget they can rely on.
And I guess that basically then implies that with use of that information, we can effectively create a budget for a task force, and would hope that the task force could work within that budget. So in other words, we won't.
Right.
I don't want a situation where we have a teleconference every day and run up a huge bill. I would expect that we work out what's a reasonable number of teleconferences to be funded by the DNSA.
Bruce, this is Jay Scott. I want to echo Marilyn's comments because I can tell you right now, I have no budget, and my firm is not going to be able to, nor willing to, pay to underwrite these calls. I am going to seek in the short term to get some private funding from interested organizations, but I certainly don't want that to become a second job for me as chair of the task force, that all I'm doing is going out and trying to ferret out funds to pay for something that DNSO needs to pay for.
Yep, fully agree. So that's going to be useful, and that will help form the budget. Any other comments?
Are we on 6 and 7 simultaneously at the moment?
No, this topic is just purely on the current DNSO budget for the first half of next year.
Okay.
So then going on to the, and certainly just as a general comment, that obviously I expect that the current representatives of the Budget Committee will participate in that process, because it is important that we get agreement on a budget for the first half of next year, and I hope that we can get agreement on that the members of the Names Council will pay their dues. The next item on the budget is really looking at the budget planning for the new GNSO, and I guess it's perhaps debatable whether that is the role of the current Names Council to look at, but assuming that the GNSO is roughly similar membership, at least from the constituency point of view going forward, one of the things that came up in discussion with Stuart Lynn and Louis was that ICANN itself needs to form an overall budget for, say, 1st of July 2003, 12 months to the 30th of June 2004,
And while ICANN itself is trying to develop its budget, it needs input from the Names Council on an estimate of the costs or the level of budget that they should be providing in terms of staff support, etc., for the GNSA. Another element of that could be that the Names Council or GNSA decides it needs, let's say it decides it needs two staff members, and the ICANN budget process ends up saying, well, we can only afford one. Then the GNSO in the future may still look to collect fees from constituencies to supplement what's available centrally from ICANN. So that's another level of consideration. So I want to flag that I believe it's important that our budget process, as a second issue, look at the budget for the GNSO from 1st of July onwards next year and consider what would be a workable budget consistent with the new ICANN structure. And what I'm proposing is that we use the budget committee to consider that, but I accept, because this has got longer term implications, that some members of the Names Council may wish to join the committee for those discussions. So again, I just open it up for comment.
Okay, Philip, about to speak.
Yep, go ahead, Philip.
All right. You've outlined, I think, the issues very, very accurately, and the agenda note also, under possible process, mentioned this, the fact that there may be a difference in desire on the GNSO in terms of necessary funding and what else may be available. If that were to happen, I think we should question the nature of our desire, because I think that the principle should be that our budget committee should determine a minimum budget necessary to support the GNSO process, because that is, after all, essentially what the board has now endorsed. That level of money should be available for ICANN, full stop. If we subsequently identify other things that we need, then we can discuss that separately. But I think that way forward is slightly different to a suggestion that we come up with the budget we think and ICANN says, well, you can only have so much. I think the principle should be, if we have and we create a reasonable minimum budget to function, that money should be available.
Yeah, I think that's very valid, and I think we'll put that in the minutes of the meeting for the use by that committee. Did you have any comments on the structure of that committee? Are you comfortable with the existing budget committee?
I think perhaps in this case, as you say, it's useful to at least open it to observers, and I think we welcome that decision.
Bruce, I'm sorry, this is Harold Feld. I've got to sign off.
Okay, thanks, Harold.
And it's Marilyn, Bruce. I might say something since I am the BC rep on that committee.
I think
it's not so much a question, and Philip's comment probably addresses, it's not so much a question of the present constituency of the group, but that some of these decisions benefit from broader participation and consideration by a number of Names Council members. So, you know, while Ken and Harold and I are there, I do think, and you're there as well as an observer, I think actually, you know, there needs to be a broad discussion. Maybe what we need to do is the budget committee puts together some thinking, and then we have a broader discussion about it. The question might be, do we have time to do that in Amsterdam and put some real thought to it, or do we need to schedule a little more time on our Names Council call?
I think there's two elements to that, Marilyn. I mean, of course, the budget committee is only a committee of the Names Council, and any decisions have to be taken by the whole Names Council, so automatically there's a process where the recommendations from the Budget Committee would be considered. But I think the other element you're saying is that the Budget Committee could perhaps announce the time of its call, if you like, on that particular topic, and other Names Council members could attend those sessions. I think that separates the two issues.
Yeah, and I think that'd be very welcome, because I do think more input early from all of you is going to be good.
Yeah, and then your issue regarding whether you discuss that in December. Look, I think I will put that to the budget committee to sort of think through its timetabling and whether they would like to, as the budget committee, meet in December at that time and invite the other members.
Bruce?
And that certainly would make sense, I think, yeah.
Yeah, Bruce?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, as a member of the budget committee, I would like to remind everybody again that a budget is nothing but a quantified plan of action. In order for us to be able to effectively present the council with a good, solid plan budget, we're going to need to have input from those people such as Jay Scott, Marilyn, and so forth, as well as anyone who's responsible for steering the effort for the new deletes task force as well, so that we can try to develop some sort of an estimate as to what resources will be necessary to sustain their efforts through the end of next June. So it isn't just a matter of factoring in teleconferences and the secretariat, but these new areas of operation as well.
Yeah, thank you, Ken. Any other comments? Okay, well, I'll basically just document the discussion here and say that and provide some direction to the budget committee consistent with what we've decided, in that we will, on this particular topic of the budget for 1st of July onwards for the GNSO, that the other Names Council members will be invited to participate in that discussion, and that the objective is to identify a minimum budget necessary to operate the GNSO in the new structure, and we're expecting that ICANN would fund that budget. I'd also recommend that the committee consider meeting with the members that are available in Amsterdam, because that also is probably an opportunity to again engage the ICANN staff, Louis or Stuart or both, in some of the discussions, because that meeting in December is meant to be about transition, and part of the transition is really understanding the budget implications. Okay, well, I think that pretty much brings us to the end of this call. At the beginning of the call, I think, Marilyn, you had one other comment. The CCNSO Assistance Group, you had a comment there that you believe there was some problems in responding in time, is that right?
I do. The DNSO has supported in the past the creation of a CCTLD supporting organization, and there's been a really strong liaison between the existing CCTLD efforts to create an SO and the constituencies. And many of the constituencies have had ongoing liaison efforts with the CC. There's an assistant policy development group, and I know that the couple, Philip Shepard, for instance, is participating in it as an individual, because that's how everyone participates in the assistant policy development assistance group. We, representing businesses who are registering and using CCTLDs, an augmentation to GTLDs, it's very important from my standpoint that, from my view, that there be an opportunity to comment productively on the drafts that are published. Right now, there's a 7-day comment period, and I consider that inadequate to take consultation with business users, even business users who have other full-time jobs, to be able to comment on this. The success of this supporting organization and its relationship, a positive relationship with the rest of the supporting organizations, I consider very critical. And clearly, if business users are going to have difficulty taking consultation, I would think that a group as diverse as CCTLD would also have difficulty. We could be sending the wrong message to the CCTLDs about the importance of their staying within the ICANN structure. And I think that puts at risk the not just the policy development structure, but ICANN.
Okay, so if I'm reading it correctly, you would like the business constituency would like the opportunity to comment And the area of comment that you're really aiming there is to support or reinforce the fact that the business constituency would like the CCLTDs to stay within ICANN. Is that a summary?
I think it's 2 points. That 7 days is not an adequate
comment. Yeah, I accept that, yeah. And I mean, what I can do as an action, I don't think I want to try and form a position at the Names Council at this instant, but as an action I can contact the chair of the assistance group and also Stuart Lynn and state that at least the business constituency and possibly other constituencies believe they would require some more time to comment on that latest report.
I think it's worth. I support absolutely what Marilyn is saying, and I was surprised, I must say, that 7 days only was presented as a timeline for that. It was either on a call I missed or a decision of the staff who are doing the administration for that assistance group. But I've certainly also seen comments from other CC registries and from the CC ADCOM that they're complaining also.
Is that right? I'm a bit surprised because I know they're not exactly a fast-moving group, so I'd be surprised if they would accept a seven-day time frame.
Exactly. So I think we all want to make progress, but the progress has to be done at a pace that is practical.
Yep, okay. Well, I'll take that as an action. As chair of the Names Council, I'll just say that I'll just summarise the discussion that we had in the call today and recommend that there be more time provided for comment.
That would be helpful.
Okay, well, I think at that point I'll close the meeting because we're just on 2 hours, I believe. The agenda topics for next meeting is to go back and look at where we are with transfers and where we are with who is. I'm hoping that those task forces will have things prepared by the end of this month so that we can have agenda items for the meeting 14 days before our meeting on the 14th of December. So at that point, I'll bid you all a good evening.
Okay.